So last time we discussed the Rankine-Selberg L function in the classical context of GL2 cross GL2. In the context of GL2 cross GL2, and essentially the discussion was over Q, but the general analysis applies for any global field. So I just want to perhaps summarize the state of knowledge concerning the general Rankine-Selberg L function, because I want to apply at least the rudimentary level of this knowledge to the oscillation of Fourier coefficients of modular forms that Rankine initiated, as I spoke about last time. So the first thing is that let F be a global field. Pi 1, a cuspidal automorphic representation of corresponding to GLN, and pi 2, one corresponding to GLM. And one has associated to this piece of information the local Satake parameters that define the L function attached to these representations. So suppose that the local factor at V looks like product 1 minus alpha V alpha VI. Alpha V, let's put I here, J over norm V to the S, inverse, where J is going from 1 to, N or M, doesn't, in this case, okay, let NI, pi I is in space. Like that, then this is for all places outside of a finite set S, then the Rankine-Selberg L function is an L function whose local factors are given in the obvious kind of way. And get into notational problems here. Pi 1 cross pi 2, rather, will be the product of just the products of all the corresponding parameters. Go over all j's and k's from 1 to, well, let's just put all j's and k's. J is going from 1 to n1, and k is going from 1 to n2. So the local factor looks like this, and then the global L function, at least the partial L function, is defined by just putting everything together. And the main theorem, I mean, there are quite a number of people responsible for the study of this L function. Of course, classically, it goes back to Rankin and Selberg. But then after that, the general case was studied by Jacquet, P.S. and Schleicha in a series of papers, mostly in the American Journal of Mathematics, entitled Rankin-Selberg L functions. And in those papers, they show that how to complete this L function at the places where we haven't talked about, and show functional equation, analytic continuation, and functional equation. And the final analysis was completed by Moglen and Walsh-Breger, who determine when there's a pole at s equals 1, when there isn't. And the beautiful theorem is more or less that the, so maybe I should put down Moglen and Walsh-Breger. So the fact of the matter is that the Rankin-Selberg L function exists for GLN cross GLM, extends to an entire function satisfies a functional equation, and extends to an entire function apart from a regular function apart from s equals 1. Regular function, analytic everywhere except s equals 1, except possibly at s, except possibly. Satisfies a functional equation, and at s equals 1, there's a pole, a simple pole, if and only if pi 2 is the contragradient of pi 1. Okay, so this is the general theorem, which allows us to kind of churn out more and more L functions through this process. Because firstly, you start with a function which you know is, so you establish holomorphy of a certain L function, and then by twisting, or more or less, twisting is a special case of the Rankin-Selberg method, you establish automorphy. And now that you've established automorphy of the object, you crank out more by taking Rankin-Selberg again and decomposing the representation. So Rankin-Selberg again and decomposing the representation gives at least some meromorphic continuation of some new L functions. Okay, you this is not a theorem, it's just a kind of a art picture, more describing what's been kind of going on. A simple case of this idea is what we will use today in trying to understand the essential ingredient about the symmetric fourth power L function and how it plays a role in resolving the question about oscillations of Fourier coefficients of cusp forms. So, going back to what I said last time, recall, that the L function that we defined, so fix pi, which is a cuspidal automorphic representation on GL2 of F, and Yes, it does. Possibly S equals 1 or 0. Yeah. Yeah, so that it, that stupid thing, the pole is sitting at S equals 1 rather than, yeah, okay. So, yeah, yeah, it's a, yeah, yeah. Okay, can I just leave it like that then? You're absolutely right. You want the pole to sit at S equals 1 when it's there, so you do some shifting of the L function. Okay, so fix pi. And look at the symmetric power L functions that I defined last time. More or less, so let's put a dot here, because this is true for almost all places. This is the symmetric power L function, and we examined last time the Rankine-Selberg L function, and noticed that essentially, as I said, I'm not going to bother about these finite number of places. It's essentially the zeta function of the field times the L function of the symmetric square. So this is the Rankine-Selberg method in general. And because we know that this extends to an entire function except we know it extends to real part s. We know it extends to an entire function apart from s equals 1. This allows us to deduce that the symmetric square is a meromorphic function, extends to a meromorphic function. And because the zeta function doesn't vanish on the line real part s equals 1, we can deduce that Ls pi r2 is regular for real part s greater than or equal to 1 by this particular result. Yeah, I'm assuming right. So let's. I'll be focusing on. Yeah, we have to assume central character is trivial. So okay, trivial central. Okay, now we have to use the Gelbart-Jacquet lift. Which tells us that the not only is this part an entire function, but it actually is, corresponds to an automorphic L function. So Ls pi r2 is in fact equal to some Ls capital pi for pi for capital pi GL3. So we have something of that shape. So we now know that it corresponds to an automorphic L function on GL3. So, Okay. So therefore, we can now take Rankine-Selberg. Capital pi cross capital pi, and so that allows us to write down this, and then when you factor it, you'll find that essentially, again, I'm being a little sloppy with the finite number of places, it'll boil down to zeta fs ls little pi r2 ls little pi R4. So there's the object that you want to get your hands on. So from holomorphy, you have to establish automorphy, and then from automorphy, you can now play the Rankine-Selberg game one more time, and allows you to deduce, get your hands on a new symmetric power L function. This is basically what and so far, we've been cracking it up to symmetric ninth power. This particular result, this is the shape that I want to use it now, allows us to say that the symmetric fourth power is regular for real part s equals 1, and that's all I'll need for this particular lecture. I may say more things about this, the application of converse theory and in the next lecture, but for now this is sufficient to understand what's going on. So let me go back now to explaining the result of Rankine. So he was looking at classical Hecke eigenforms. For example, the Ramanujan tau function coming from the cusp form delta of z. In the in Hardy's 12 lectures on Ramanujan, delivered in 1940 or thereabouts, Hardy shows that the Ramanujan conjecture at that time, of course, wasn't proved. He shows that this thing is omega n to the 11 halves. Now recall the notation omega, the omega notation, what does it mean? We say that a function f of x is omega of g of x. Usually g of x is a positive function. So we say this if there exists a constant c positive, so that mod f of x is bigger than some constant times g of x for infinitely many x going to infinity, infinitely often. So that's the meaning of this notation. Infinitely often as x goes to infinity. Yeah, otherwise in a tiny interval you can, of course. Yeah. Okay. So you have this, and you also have the notation plus or minus, well, maybe I'll skip that for now. Okay. Let me just say that one could also speak about positive and negative oscillations, and those questions also will have relevance to the symmetric power L functions. Okay. Now, Rankin showed that limb soup plus infinity in this 1970 paper. And he indicated that the Sato-Tate conjecture implies that tau n, that there is this constant, c positive, such that tau n is omega to the 11 halves exponential c log n over log log n. Now, I tried to indicate at the very end of last day the general strategy for trying to prove some things like this. Well, the strategy is this. What does the Sato-Tate conjecture say? It says that if alpha is less than beta, is an alpha beta is sitting inside a minus pi pi, the Sato-Tate conjecture says that the number of primes, p less than or equal to x, such that the angles that I had talked about earlier, the angle that's attached to the local parameter alpha sub p, the theta p, the number of such primes is asymptotic to the integral from alpha to beta, 2 over pi sine squared theta d theta. So this is the density times the number of primes up to x. It's x over log x. So this is the Sato-Tate conjecture for any alpha and beta. This is the conjecture. And in the first lecture, I indicated how the knowledge of the holomorphy of all the symmetric power L functions in the half-plane real part s bigger than or equal to 1 allows us to deduce this theorem. So, and I also pointed out that that Langlands was trying to describe a method of proving this theorem using knowledge about all these symmetric power L functions. It turns out that, I don't know where I read that, but I couldn't find it in Langlands' paper. I only found discussion of the Selberg eigenvalue conjecture and the Ramanujan conjecture, but not the Sato-Tate problem. But somehow or other over the years, I've gotten into my head that it was Langlands who first pointed out this approach. So, can anyone correct me? History. Tate? No. 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 Tate didn't. No, he didn't do that. He didn't. He didn't. He didn't bring in the symmetric power L functions. That was Sayre in his book on abelian analytic representations. But I think that it's not that paper that I was referring to. It's another paper of Langlands, and I'll have to find it, where he mentions the Sato-Tate question. Anyway, because we're not making progress in one full sweep, that is, the knowledge of all the symmetric power L functions are not coming in one full blow, it is natural to ask whether we could obtain results of a Chebyshev nature, you know, the nature like Chebyshev has bounds for pi x, lower bounds and upper bounds. So is it possible for, given a sector alpha beta, is it possible to obtain lower bounds and upper bounds for the number of primes whose state angle lies in a given sector? And the purpose of this lecture is to show that partial knowledge of the symmetric L functions will give us this kind of information. Okay, so Chebyshev type theorems toward the conjecture of Sato and Tate. Okay, so around that. Okay, so the first thing to let me finish this strategy. So the idea, here's your graph of the cosine function. So the idea is to get lots of primes whose theta p lies in a sufficiently small sector. So Sato Tate implies number of primes for delta sufficiently small, number of primes less than x, such that theta p lies in minus delta delta, say, is certainly some constant depending on delta x over log x. We really don't care. We really don't care about what the constants are. It suffices to have positive proportion. Then what happens here is that now take capital N to be the product of the primes P less than X, whose angle lies in this interval. Okay. Then log N is summation log P. Is bigger than or equal to some C delta X. On the other hand, log N without any conjectures is just summation log P, P less than X, and by the Chebyshev or prime number theorem, it's O of X. So whatever it is, log n is more or less of the order of x with this particular construction. And why do we care about this construction? Well, because if we take our Fourier coefficient, let's say tau n will be the product of tau p's because it's a multiplicative function, and each of the tau p's is p to the 11 halves times 2 times cosine theta p, and theta p is very close to 0. So cosine theta p will be very close to 1. And 2 times cosine theta p will be very close to 2. And so you're going to get a factor of 2 for every prime factor you have here. Okay, so this gives us for example, tau n product of the primes, 11 halves times something very close. So you get a factor of essentially 2 for every prime factor. Well, how many prime factors are there for n? Well, at least this many. So you end up getting C of delta x over log x. Now the question is, what is the relationship between x and n? Well, we just said that x is more or less log n. Okay, so this log n is bounded by x, constant x, and log n is bounded by below from below by x. So more or less log x is the same as log n. So you essentially get n to the 11/2 exponential some c of delta log 2. Log 2 is more or less positive, so that's sufficient for our purposes. So c1 log n over log n. One could be a little bit precise with the constants, but that's not relevant. So this is the Rankine's argument about how Sato Tate should give you the information about the order of growth of these Fourier coefficients in general. Now the point is that this is about the best you can expect, because if F is a cusp form, a normalized Hecke eigenform, weight K, and let's say that F of Z is summation A sub N of, well, A sub F of N E to the 2 pi I N Z, then the value of the Fourier coefficient can be written as in this way. Okay, so well, let me just make an elementary remark about these functions, which are really Chebyshev polynomials. So just write down the definition of the sine function. And then if you write it like this, x equal to e to the I theta, y equal to e to the minus I theta, then you can see that the maximal value of this function is bounded by alpha plus 1 from this formula. And so that means that, in general, AF of n up there is bounded by n to the k minus 1 over 2 times the product of alpha plus 1s, where p the alpha is the highest power of p dividing n. But this is just the divisor function here, the number of divisors of n. This is less than or equal to n to the k minus 1 over 2 times the divisor function. And it's an elementary exercise to determine the maximal order of the divisor function, which you can find in Hardy and Wright, for example, that this is O of n to the k minus 1 over 2 exponential constant, better not use the same constant, C2 log n over log n. If you work it out, C2 turns out to be log 2. So it's more or less the kind of constant we would have gotten if we were very, if we had the full strength of the Sato-Tate conjecture, I would have been able to put C1 equal to log 2 up there in the omega estimate. Here also you would get C2 equal to log 2. Okay. So this tells you that this is the maximal order and that you can't really beat that. So as I said, now we'll try and see what, how partial information about symmetric power L functions will lead you to get kind of Chebyshev type estimates toward the Sato-Tate conjecture, and then we'll realize to our surprise and joy that the state of present state of knowledge is enough to prove the omega estimate that you would have gotten had you had the full Sato-Tate. Okay. So here's the theorem. Suppose that each of the Elza bars, each of the symmetric power L functions extend to an analytic function for all R for all M less than 2, capital M plus 2, then each of the statements for any delta positive I'm going to work over Q, okay, although the result is general, because I'm going to write down theta sub p's like I've been doing in the calculation there. So 2 cos theta p, so here pi is and trivial Nevin typos, trivial central character. So for a positive proportion of the primes, we're going to have this inequality satisfied. Three, for any epsilon positive, two cos theta p is bigger than beta sub m minus epsilon, where radius of M is 1 over 4 M plus 2. All of these statements holds for a positive density of primes. Okay. The moral of the story is that if you're aiming for Chebyshev-type estimates for the Sato-Tate question, the length of the interval is important. Because if the length of the interval alpha beta is getting smaller and smaller, you'll need more and more terms in the kind of trigonometric expansion of the characteristic function. You'll need more, and the more cosine thetas you have, you'll need knowledge about the symmetric power L functions for those terms, and therefore that will control the effectiveness of your results. Now, two immediate corollaries. First corollary is if we set delta equal to square root 2 over m plus 2 in the first result, we get the symmetric result that the number of primes p less than x with and I think this brings out more what I'm trying to say, this particular result. The number of primes for which cosine theta p lies between these two numbers is bigger than x over log x. So this is an interval about pi by 2 rather. Yeah. Negative pi to pi. You need an interval of 2 pi. It doesn't, plus or minus really doesn't matter. No, I'm trying to in the omega theorems there, we're trying to get cosine theta p close to 1. That's correct. But the Sato-Tate says it doesn't matter what angle you want it to close to, you should always get a positive density. And so here what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to shift the intervals and look at other intervals, maybe close to pi by 2 even, or plus or minus pi by 2. And this is the situation where I'm dealing with where theta p is either on the pi by 2 or minus pi by 2. So how many primes are there where it's close to that? There again, you get a positive density. There's nothing special about 0. I mean, 0 is only relevant for that particular problem, okay? I mean, the next corollary is the kind of thing that we're really after, and that is for a positive density of primes, in my notation of a sub f of p, and this comes from part two. If you look at part two and put in m equals 1. In part two, if you put capital M equals 1 in here, you see that you get 4 plus 2 over 3, that's 2, square root 2 minus epsilon. So that means if I had information up to the fourth symmetric power, I would get that AF of P is bigger than, well, this is irrelevant, I get a root 2 there, which is bigger than 1. Remember, in the original Sato-Tate, with the full strength of the Sato-Tate, you get it as big as 2, but here, with this meager knowledge, you can get it up to root 2, and the important fact is that this has to be bigger than 1, because when you take log of it, it has to be, you know, you want to get a positive constant. Okay? So these are like partial results toward the Sato-Tate conjecture. And okay. I should mention that there are two papers in the these results are cribbed from my earlier paper. I believe there are two papers that appeared afterwards. So this is a paper by Shahidi in the CRM workshop on elliptic curves. Has a paper where and an appendix by Sayre, where the test functions that I'm going to be using have been improved, and there are better test functions you can use and get better numbers. But and these things have been improved. Okay, and as you know, with the higher symmetric power L functions up to 9, you can even go further, and I think that's in your latest one of your latest papers. Okay. But so Sayre, and then came for the latest. So these things can always be improved. Now here's the method of obtaining these results. Boils down to Fourier analysis on SU2, and that boils down to checking a bunch of trigonometric identities. Okay, so we will begin with so given that LS pi r sub m is regular for real part of s greater than or equal to 1 and non-vanishing there, well, it's not vanishing in that plane, in that whole plane, I think we need that, allows us by the Tauberian theorem explained in the first lecture, allows us to deduce everything is with trivial central character. Is it that this is little o of x over log x? Summation of these more or less sines and cosines. And this inside thing can be evaluated, as I mentioned somewhere, right there on that board. Just a geometric series which you evaluate, and you get that summation p less than x sine m plus 1 theta p over sine theta p is little o of x over log x. Now, let's write u and, of course, theta to be sine n plus 1 theta over sine theta. This is usually called a Chebyshev polynomial of the first kind. It's a polynomial in cos theta, this thing. So that's why I write it like that. And tn of cos theta is cos n theta. Although in retrospect, I think the notation should be switched around, because if you look at the nth Hecke operator acting on, it really is. Anyway, so you have these recurrence relations. So the relationship between these TNs and UNs is this neat, very nice formula. So, for example, for n equals 2, what do we have? We have 2 times summation p less than x. So let me write it down first. 2 times t2 of cos theta p is u2 of cos theta p minus u0 of cos theta p. But of course, u0 of anything is just 1, okay? So this is just, and u2 of cos theta p is sine 3 theta p over sine theta p. As I said, this is just high school trigonometry. You plug this back in. And you end up getting, when we sum this, so summation p less than x, t2 of cos theta p is a summation of u2 of cos theta p minus u0, which is just pi of x. Now u2 of cos theta p, all for all these things, so this, we know this for all m bigger than or equal to 1. That's the holomorphy of all these symmetric power L functions for m bigger than or equal to 1. We know that all these sums are little o of x over log x. So therefore, this sum is x over, a little o of x over log x. So this is minus, this allows us to deduce that summation p less than x, t2 of cos theta p is asymptotic to minus 1 half pi of x. And t1 of cos theta p, t1 corresponds to just cos theta p, and that corresponds, that's also corresponds to u1, because u1 is sine 2 theta is 2 sine theta cos theta, so more or less knowing that the sum here for m equals 1 gives a little o x over log x contribution allows us to deduce that this is little o of x over log x. So having the knowledge about the symmetric power L functions allows us to deduce, I mean, that's equivalent, the regularity of the symmetric power L functions allows us to deduce all these sums are small. And from these sums, we can pass to the cosines via this recurrence relations. Make sense? Okay. And now, I'll leave this as a an exercise. The nice thing is that you can write powers of the cosine function. As linear combinations of the t's, so powers of the cosine function can be written now in terms of the t's. And because we have these sums are all small, that's saying that un of cos theta p's are all small, summation un of cos theta p's are all small. And from this recurrence, as long as we're outside of those two nasty ones, you get that tn of cos theta p's are also small, provided n is bigger than or equal to 2. N is bigger than or equal to 3. For 2, you have this kind of spurious behavior that's coming from the Rankine-Selberg thing. And for the first level, it's okay. Okay, so you have these two things to worry about. But for the other ones, this particular function here is just un of um of cos theta p. But the summation um of cos theta p's are all small, provided m is at least 1. So it allows you to say that these guys are also small. And that's what's happening here. If I want to study the moments of the Fourier coefficients, you know, AP squared, AP4, AP, you know, higher and higher moments, which is natural if you want to study a sequence of numbers, this is telling me that these higher moments are related to these trigonometric polynomials, and these guys are related to the characters on SU2 in this fashion. And therefore, from this information, we're able to get information about the moments. Okay. So this is the, I'll leave this as an exercise to do. Okay, so we have this nice identity, therefore summation p less than x 2 cos theta p to the power r, let's make it to the power 2r, actually let's just leave it like this, it's fine. So that's 2 times summation, well plug this identity in here and then interchange summation, so you get k going from 0 to r prime, r choose k, summation p less than x, t sub r minus 2k of cosine of theta p. So the contribution from all these sums, as we have observed above, from this relation, I should have written it down. The contribution of summation p less than x tn cos theta p is always little o of x over log x, provided we're away from the trivial character, and we're away from the trivial character as long as n is strictly bigger than 2. Is that okay? But because of the trivial character enters into the two, first T1 and T2, we have to be careful with those. So you can see now here, as long as r minus 2k is not 0 or 2, actually we only have to worry about, r minus 2k, if it's 0, it's pi of x. T0 just gives a pi of x. If r minus 2k is 0 or r minus 2k is 2, you'll get some non-trivial contribution from these sums, but otherwise it's always little o of x over log x. Okay? So we see that summation tr minus 2k of cos theta p p less than x is little of x over log x, unless r minus 2k is 0 or r minus 2k is 2. Oops. In particular, you immediately see that the only trouble will arise when r is even. So if r is odd, in particular, if r is odd, the whole thing should be just for r odd, 2 cos theta p to the power r p less than x is little o of x over log x, which is a kind of a reasonable thing to expect, because we expect the cosine, the angles to be uniformly distributed with respect to that measure. Therefore, the positive and the negative should kind of get equal weights, and there should be enough cancellation that there shouldn't be a main term, which is exactly what's happening for r odd. For r even, you're going to get some contribution. And what is it? I'll keep this on. So for r even, we have to watch out for r even, there will be a contribution. Okay, there will be a contribution. What is it? Well, when r minus 2k is 0, you get a pi of x, and when r minus 2k is 2, you get a minus a half pi of x. You combine everything together, you get the following beautiful result. Theorem. Modulo the same hypotheses, that is, I'm assuming the various conditions, which I won't write, p less than x, 2 cos theta p to the power 2r is equal to 1 over r plus 1, 2r choose r, x over log x. So you get this very nice looking main term. So that's the behavior of these moments is given by these Catalan numbers. That's what the nice thing is. Notice, for r equals 1, what does the result say? The result is saying 2 cos theta p squared is asymptotic to, well, when r equals 1, 2 choose 1, that's 2, 2 divided by 2 is 1, so that's just x over log x. This is the Rankine-Selberg result. Okay, which says that on average, this is behaving like 1. That's what it's saying. But that's not good enough to deduce the oscillation theorems that we want. Okay, for r equals 2, you all of a sudden get the information you need. You get summation p less than x, 2 cosine theta p to the power 4, is asymptotic to what? Well, r equals 2, that's 4, choose 2, divided by 3, and it turns out to be 2. Which tells you that on average, this is behaving like 4th root of 2, which is bigger than 1. Which is enough to prove. So this is the calculation that needs to be done. I mean, Rankine, when he pointed out the Sato-Tate, you can't get this kind of information directly from Sato-Tate. You have to kind of go through this route of unraveling what the symmetric power L functions are really giving you, and get these moments, k calculate these moments. And the moments will tell you that the values are getting bigger and bigger. This is what how big they're getting. So if you had information up to the limit of this thing, turns out to be 2. So on average, cos theta p, 2 cos theta p should works out to be 2. Yeah. So this is what we have. Now notice what I said that I said that the last result tells you that on average 2 cos theta p behaves like in absolute value behaves like the 4th root of 2, and that's sufficient for our thing. But here I'm saying that for a positive density of primes, it's as big as the square root of 2, which is much better than what you would have gotten. And for that, you need to do a little bit of elementary Fourier analysis. Maybe I just spend 5 minutes to indicate how this goes, because this is what's contained. I mean, in my early paper that was written in 83, I had test functions which were not the optimal ones. And I think in the appendix to Shahidi's papers, Sarah shows how to get the optimal polynomials. But I'm going to stick with my early examples. Now consider, so let me say this. We can refine these results. We can refine these results as follows. Let's take the polynomial p sub m of x, x squared minus 4, because I'm interested in where the thing is lying, okay, between minus 2 and 2, x minus alpha, x minus beta. So here's my picture. So a picture of this graph is something like, well, it's got a 0 at plus or minus 2, that's for sure. And then it goes up. It's, well, it may not be symmetric, but that's beside the point. Something like this. So here's minus 2. Here's 2. Here's some alpha here that I'm interested in. And here's some beta. And I'm interested in making 2 cos theta p big and positive. So this polynomial is going to help me arrange the angles in the right place that I want them to lie. I think I can push this up. Okay, skipping quite a number of details, the name of the game is pick this polynomial with alpha and beta to be specified, like you always do in analytic number theory. You don't pick them at the beginning, you pick them at the end. And you now consider the value of the polynomial, p sub m of 2 cos theta p less than or equal to x. Oops, I'm sorry, I said x squared minus 4 to the power m. It's an nth degree polynomial. And when you, so it's an nth degree polynomial, it's got some bunch of coefficients, which are integer coefficients. So well, they may have this alpha and beta in them, but they will basically be powers of 2 cos theta p. But we already know how powers of 2 cos theta p behave. once you have the knowledge of the symmetric power functions up to a point. Okay, so I'm going to control the degree of this polynomial m up to whatever the state of knowledge is. And then when you work all this out, you end up getting this. So if you now look at theorem one, the theorem over there, and supposing you're trying to establish the first part of the theorem, so you choose alpha to be minus delta. So here, what's the point of this argument? Let me try and explain a little bit before I proceed. The idea is I've managed to choose a polynomial which is most of the time negative, but it's only positive in the interval that I want it to be. So supposing I have that the summation of Pm of 2 cos theta p comes out to be positive times x over log x, something positive times x over log x. Okay? That would mean that for a good chunk of the primes, this quantity better be positive. Otherwise, you're not going to get a positive answer at the end. Okay? And therefore, for a good chunk of the primes, 2 cos theta p is actually sitting between alpha and beta where you want it to be. Now, this is basically the strategy in this thing. By increasing the power of m, the order of approximation gets better and better. So we choose alpha equal to minus delta and choose beta. So, you see, beta was free. Choose beta so that, well, depends on your knowledge. If today Henry Kim proves only up to the ninth power, that means minus 1 to the 9 is odd. So you want to make this negative so that you can get a positive thing. So you can control your beta according to your state of knowledge. So choose beta so that alpha beta, let's say, is less than minus 2 over m plus 2 if m is even, and alpha beta is bigger than 2 over m plus, sorry, if m is odd, alpha beta being minus, bigger than minus 2 over m plus 2 if m is even. These technical conditions are irrelevant. The fact of the matter is you want to arrange this whole thing to be positive so that you can get the cosine theta p to land in that little sector. Everywhere else it's negative. And this allows us to deduce part one of the theorem. Well, that's basically the strategy in this thing. And for part two and part three, you more or less do the same kind of thing, games with different trigonometric polynomials. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. So we rearrange that. When that's why, okay? And then the other way around. Unless you're right that the sign matters and it enters here. Yeah. I mean, this picture is not the typical picture, okay? This is just a kind of, I mean, I've tried to arrange it that most of the time you can get it to be positive only in that range. Yeah. Okay. And as I said, the other parts are proved by choosing different trigonometric polynomials. Okay. Now, there's one more result that I wanted to explain. Looks like I'm running out of time very quickly. And this, it has to do with Rankine's remarkable theorem concerning the absolute values of Fourier coefficients of modular forms. Rankine proved the following theorem using Shahidi's result. So, Rankine showed that summation n less than x the actual delta that he calculates is, I think, 1 over 18, but I can't guarantee that now. But there is a delta positive such that the absolute values of the Fourier coefficients after you normalize with the appropriate thing turns out to be x over log x to the delta. Now, this is an amazing theorem because, remember, we just finished proving that these Fourier coefficients are oscillating and they're getting very big, as big as exponential constant log n over log log n. But the numbers where this is happening is kind of like a very sparse set. Even though the Fourier coefficients are shooting up, they're not shooting up most of the time. They're actually much smaller than you. And this is telling you that. So again, this was first deduced by Rankine using Sato-Tate. Then he realized that you could use just the symmetric fourth power. And the way that works is as follows. So you just look at, let's define the following Dirichlet series. Let's define these Dirichlet series. What's the relationship between these Dirichlet series and the symmetric power L functions? Well, one can show, this I'll leave as an exercise because, again, it's an exercise in trigonometry. So zeta s, zeta, psi 2 of s is just the symmetric square. So in my notation, it's R2. Zeta s, psi 2s, psi 4s is ls pi r sub 4. I should just more or less put dots there because they're, you have to be a little careful about the ramified places, but I won't be. Okay, that's what you have. So that's the relationship between these psis. I mean, you could continue, but this is enough for the analysis that Rankine gives. And Rankine shows that the following inequality is true. He actually writes these down, K and L, L and M, and I didn't have a chance to find out the numbers this morning. So I'll just write down the final answer, where K minus L is F of beta plus 1. F of beta is 2 to the beta minus 1, 2 to the beta plus 3 to the 2 minus beta minus 1. The exact shape of these inequalities is irrelevant. The essential point here is to know that the absolute value raised to the 2 beta power is being not expressed as an inequality involving 1 cos 2 theta and cos 4 theta. And again, because cos 2 theta when r equals 2 and cos 4 theta are really involving the second symmetric, the symmetric square and the fourth symmetric power, we see that we should be able to get some information on absolute values of the coefficients from this particular result. No, they're not. That's right. They're not. They're not. These are not automorphic L functions. That's why they have to be combined and clubbed together like that.
So by anyway,
yeah, yeah. That's enough. I mean, that's what you're getting going to get right from there, right? Now, the main point is that you look at this Dirichlet series. Consider. Consider A prime, A plus of N over N of the S, where A plus is two beta. Then what happens is that this Dirichlet series, so the 2 beta power Dirichlet series as a function of a real variable s is less than or equal to a plus of n over n of the s just by looking at Euler factors. A prime is this. So this is boils down to zeta s. So this is less than or equal to zeta s to the power k, psi 2 of s to the power l, psi 4 of s to the power m, and h3 of s, where h3 of s is regular non-vanishing for real part s bigger than or equal to a half. Okay, so the point now is that this Dirichlet series, we don't know anything really about, but we have this Dirichlet series, which we, this is A prime, and A plus. A plus is whatever you get when you do this. Okay, sorry about that. Now this Dirichlet series, you know, we can analyze because we know about psi 2 and psi 4 now. Remember, psi 2 boils down to having a zero of order, a simple zero at s equals 1, and this has a simple pole. So the pole will contribute a k. There's a pole of order k here, and there's a pole of order minus l here. And there's nothing from psi 4. H3 is regular and non-zero for real s bigger than or equal to half, okay? All I've done is I factored out, in order to save time, I factored out contribution basically from square-free things, and I've kind of thrown the other squares of primes into the. Have I? Yes, I have. Thank you. So, yeah. So let's drop that. Okay. What does A plus mean? That's a good question. Okay, let me write things down more carefully. Okay. Now I've defined. Let's call this guy U of theta, this trigonometric polynomial here. And let's define AP plus of S to be 1 plus U of theta P, P to the minus S plus so more or less ignoring the higher terms from squares onwards and focusing one's attention only on the primes. And so A plus now of n over n to the s is equal to product for the primes AP plus of s. And as I said, if you just ignore the other terms for a second and see what's going on, you see then that the Dirichlet series A plus of N, just by looking at the contribution from the primes alone, not the prime powers, not squares and cubes and whatnot, you see that these are the first three factors, and then the rest, the stuff that's left over, is regular for real part S bigger than or equal to half. So you end up getting this Dirichlet series, which, as I just said, Is this better? Up to an inverse, yeah, thank you. There's an inverse there. So psi 2 of S to the L, psi 4 of S to the L, to the M times H3 of S. Okay, so this is what we have. And now by the fact that the order of the pole at S equals 1 is K minus L, and therefore we can apply a Tauberian theorem provided, of course, K minus L is less than or equal to 1. And deduce that summation A plus of N, hope I have it right this time, is asymptotic to some constant, which is positive x log x to the k minus L minus 1. And when you, as I said, when you have to have k minus L less than or equal to 1, and that forces you to choose beta equal to a half, and when you do that, you end up getting that this quantity here is actually negative. And then you end up deducing this result. Why do I emphasize this result? Well, the reason is in work that I did with Kumar on this, on the non-vanishing of quadratic twists of modular L series, this plays a crucial role. And this is an analytic hypothesis of Kolyvagin that he needed in order to show the finiteness of the Tate-Chaffrevich groups for curves of rank bounded by one, modular elliptic curves. So in showing finiteness of Shah, you need a technical result at the final, as a final tour de force, of something, you need a saving of delta, and for that you need the symmetric fourth power L function. I should mention that Henrik Ivanovich, in his characteristic style, eliminated the use of the fourth symmetric power L function from that calculation in the end and obtained a better error term. So, but originally, for a couple of years at least, this is where things stood. Okay, so I'll stop here.